And a big thank you to our sponsors. Well, it's been a little while, but we're at the point where Nicholas Nickleby is at Dothbury Hall, where he's discovered that the boys that he is expected to tutor are being treated appallingly. The daughter of Mr. Squeers, the headmaster, a very loose term to use for him, and his wife run a pretty horrible place for the young people who were there. And of course, their daughter Fanny has a crush on Nicholas Nickleby, and it's led to a big fight between her and Tilda. Meanwhile, Nicholas's uncle has found work for his sister in a dress shop millinery type arrangement. Of course, his attitude is that if you don't work, you don't eat, you don't eat, you die, and you have to work and earn your bread. Of course, he is a usurer and a very, very wealthy man, but he resents doing anything for his brother's family. And we're at the point where Ralph Nickleby, the uncle, has turned up and is talking about providing work for his niece. "Repining is of no use, ma'am," said Ralph. "Of all fruitless errands, sending a tear to look after a day that is gone is the most fruitless."
"Oh, so it is," sobbed Mrs. Nickleby. "So it is.
As you feel so keenly in your own purse and person the consequences of inattention to business, ma'am," said Ralph, "I am sure you will impress upon your children the necessity of attaching themselves to it early in life."
"Oh, of course, I must see that," rejoined Mrs. Nickleby. "Sad experience, you know, brother-in-law. Kate, my dear, put that down in the next letter to Nicholas, or remind me to do it if I write."
Ralph paused for a few moments, and seeing that he had now made pretty sure of the mother, in case the daughter objected to his proposition, went on to say, "The situation that I have made interest to procure, ma'am, is with a milliner and dressmaker, in short."
"A milliner?" cried Mrs. Nickleby.
"A milliner and a dressmaker, ma'am," replied Ralph. "Dressmakers in London, as I need not remind you, ma'am, who are so well acquainted with all matters in the ordinary routine of life, make large fortunes, keep equipages, become persons of great wealth and fortune." Now, the first ideas called up in Mrs. Nickleby's mind by the words milliner and dressmaker were connected with certain wicker baskets lined with black oilskin, which she remembered to have seen carried to and fro in the streets. But as Ralph proceeded, these disappeared and were replaced by visions of large houses at the West End, neat private carriages and a banker's book, all of which images succeeded each other with such rapidity that he had no sooner finished speaking than she nodded her head and said, "Very true," with great appearance of satisfaction.
"What your uncle says is very true, Kate, my dear," said Mrs. Nickleby. "I recollect that when your poor papa and I came to town after we were married, that a young lady brought me home a chip cottage bonnet with white and green trimming and green Persian lining in her own carriage, which drove up to the door full gallop. At least I am not quite certain whether it was her own carriage or a hackney chariot, but I remember very well that the horse dropped down dead as he was turning round, and that poor papa said he hadn't any corn for a fortnight."
This anecdote, so strikingly illustrative of the opulence of milliners, was not received with any great demonstration of feeling, inasmuch as Kate hung down her head while it was relating, and Ralph manifested very intelligible symptoms of extreme patience. "The lady's name," said Ralph, hastily striking in, "is Mantalini, Madame Mantalini. I know her. She lives near Cavendish Square. If your daughter is disposed to try after the situation, I'll take her there directly."
Have you nothing to say to your uncle, my love?" inquired Mrs. Nickleby.
"A great deal," replied Kate, "but not now. I would rather speak to him when we are alone. It will save his time if I thank him and say what I wish to say to him as we walk along." With these words, Kate hurried away to hide the traces of emotion that were stealing down her face and to prepare herself for the walk, while Mrs. Nickleby amused her brother-in-law by giving him, with many tears, a detailed account of the dimensions of a rosewood cabinet piano they had possessed in their days of affluence, together with a minute description of 8 drawing room chairs with turned legs and green chintz squabs to match the curtains, which had cost £2.15 apiece and had gone at the sale for a mere nothing. These reminiscences were at length cut short by Kate's return, in her walking dress, when Ralph, who had been fretting and fuming during the whole time of her absence, lost no time and used very little ceremony in descending into the street. "Now," he said, taking her arm, "walk as fast as you can, and you'll get into the step that you'll have to walk to business with every morning." So saying, he led Kate off at a good round pace towards Cavendish Square.
"I am very much obliged to you, Uncle," said the young lady, after they had hurried on in silence for some time.
"Very." "I'm glad to hear it," said Ralph. "I hope you'll do your duty."
I will try to please, Uncle," replied Kate. "Indeed, I..."
"Don't begin to cry," growled Ralph. "I hate crying."
"It's very foolish, I know, Uncle," began poor Kate.
"It is," replied Ralph, stopping her short, "and very affected besides. Let me see no more of it."
Perhaps this was not the best way to dry the tears of a young and sensitive female about to make her first entry on an entirely new scene of life among cold and uninterested strangers, but it had its effect notwithstanding. Kate coloured deeply, breathed quickly for a few moments, and then walked on with a firmer and a more determined step. It was a curious contrast to see how the timid country girl shrunk through the crowd that hurried up and down the streets, giving way to the press of people and clinging closely to Ralph, as though she feared to lose him in the throng, and how the stern and hard-featured man of business went doggedly on, elbowing the passengers aside, and now and then exchanging a gruff salutation with some passing acquaintance, who turned to look back upon his pretty charge with looks expressive of surprise, and seemed to wonder at the ill-assorted companionship. But it would have been a stranger contrast still, to have read the hearts that were beating side by side, to have laid bare the gentle innocence of the one and the rugged villainy of the other, to have hung upon the guileless thoughts of the affectionate girl and been amazed that, among all the wily plots and calculations of the old man, there should not be one word or figure denoting thought of death or the grave. But so it was, and stranger still, though this is a thing of every day, the warm young heart palpitated with 1,000 anxieties and apprehensions, while that of the old worldly man lay rusting in its cell, beating only as a piece of cunning mechanism, and yielding to no one throb of hope or fear or love or care for any living thing. "Uncle," said Kate, when she judged they must be near their destination, "I must ask one question of you. I am to live at home?"
"At home?" replied Ralph. "Where is that?"
I mean, with my mother, the widow," said Kate emphatically.
"You will live, to all intents and purposes, here," rejoined Ralph. "For here you will take your meals, and here you will be from morning till night, occasionally perhaps till morning again."
"But at night, I mean," said Kate. "I cannot leave her, Uncle. I must have some place that I can call a home. It will be wherever she is, you know, and it may be a very humble one."
"Maybe," said Ralph, walking faster, in the impatience provoked by the remark. "Must be, you mean. May you be a humble one? Is the girl mad?"
The word slipped from my lips. I didn't mean it, indeed," urged Kate.
"I hope not," said Ralph.
But my question, Uncle, you have not answered it."
"Why, I anticipated something of the kind," said Ralph, "and, though I object very strongly, mind, have provided against it. I spoke of you as an out-of-door worker, so you will go to this home that may be humble every night."
There was comfort in this. Kate poured forth many thanks for her uncle's consideration, which Ralph received as if he deserved them all, and they arrived without any further conversation at the dressmaker's door, which displayed a very large plate with Madame Mantalini's name and occupation, and was approached by a handsome flight of steps. There was a shop to the house, but it was led off to an importer of Otto of Roses.
Madame Mantalini's showrooms were on the first floor, a fact which was notified to the nobility and gentry by the casual exhibition, near the handsomely curtained windows, of two or three elegant bonnets of the newest fashion and some costly garments in the most approved taste. A liveried footman opened the door, and in reply to Ralph's inquiry whether Madame Mantalini was at home, ushered them through a handsome hall and up a spacious staircase into the show saloon, which comprised two spacious drawing rooms and exhibited an immense variety of superb dresses and materials for dresses, some arranged on stands, others laid carelessly on sofas, and others again scattered over the carpet, hanging on the cheval glasses or mingling in some other way with the rich furniture of various descriptions, which was profusely displayed. They waited here a much longer time than was agreeable to Mr. Ralph Nickleby, who eyed the gaudy frippery about him with very little concern, and was at length about to pull the bell, when a gentleman suddenly popped his head into the room, and seeing somebody there, as suddenly popped it out again. "Here, hello!" cried Ralph. "Who's that?" At the sound of Ralph's voice the head reappeared, and the mouth, displaying a very long row of very white teeth, uttered in a mincing tone the words, "Oh, damn it! What, Nickleby? Oh, damn it!" Having uttered which ejaculations, the gentleman advanced and shook hands with Ralph with great warmth. He was dressed in a gorgeous morning gown, with a waistcoat and Turkish trousers of the same pattern, a pink silk neckerchief and bright green slippers, and had a very copious watch-chain wound around his body. Moreover, he had whiskers and a moustache, both dyed black and gracefully curled.
"Damn it! You don't mean to say you want me, do you, damn it?" said this gentleman, smiting Ralph on the shoulder.
"Not yet," said Ralph sarcastically.
"Ha, ha, ha, damn it,"
cried the gentleman, when, wheeling around to laugh with greater elegance, he encountered Kate Nickleby, who was standing near.
"My niece," said Ralph.
"Oh, I remember,"
said the gentleman, striking his nose with the knuckle of his forefinger as a chastening for his forgetfulness.
"Damn it, I remember what you came for. Oh, step this way, Nickleby, my dear. Will you follow me? They all follow me, Nickleby. Always did, damn it, always."
Giving loose to the playfulness of his imagination after this fashion, the gentleman led the way to a private sitting room on the second floor, scarcely less elegantly furnished than the apartment below, where the presence of a silver coffee pot, an eggshell and sloppy china for one, seemed to show that he had just breakfasted.
Sit down, my dear,"
said the gentleman, first staring Miss Nickleby out of countenance and then grinning in delight at the achievement.
"This cursed high room takes one breath away. Those infernal sky parlours. I'm afraid I must move, Nickleby."
"I would, by all means,"
replied Ralph, looking bitterly round.
"What a damned rum fellow you are, Nickleby,"
said the gentleman.
The damnedest, longest-headed, queerest-tempered old coiner of gold and silver ever was, damn it."
Having complimented Ralph to this effect, the gentleman rang the bell and stared at Miss Nickleby until it was answered, when he left off to bid the man desire his mistress to come directly, after which he began again and left off no more until Madame Mantalini appeared. The dressmaker was a buxom person, handsomely dressed and rather good-looking, but much older than the gentleman in the Turkish trousers, whom she had wedded some 6 months before. His name was originally Muntle, but it had been converted by an easy transition into Mantalini, the lady rightly considering that an English appellation would be of serious injury to the business. He had married on his whiskers, upon which property he had previously subsisted, in a genteel manner for some years, and which he had recently improved after patient cultivation by the addition of a moustache, which promised to secure him an easy independence, his share in the labours of the business being at present confined to spending the money, and occasionally, when that ran short, driving to Mr. Ralph Nickleby to procure discount at a percentage for the customer's bills.
"Oh, my life," said Mr. Mantini. "Oh, what a damned devil of a time you have been."
"I didn't even know Mr. Nickleby was here, my love," said Madame Mantalini.
Then,
"What a doubly damned infernal rascal that footman must be, my soul,"
remonstrated Mr. Mantalini. "My dear," said Madame,
that is entirely your fault.
Oh, my fault? My heart's joy?
Certainly, returned the lady. What can you expect, dearest, if you will not correct the man?
Oh, correct the man, my soul's delight?
Yes, I'm sure he wants speaking to badly enough, said Madame, pouting.
Then do not vex yourself, said Mr. Mantalini.
He shall be horsewhipped till he cries out damnably. And with this preface, Mr. Mantalini kissed Madame Mantalini, and after that performance, Madame Mantalini pulled Mr. Mantalini playfully by the ear, which done, they descended to business.
Now, ma'am, said Ralph, who had looked on at all this with such scorn as few men can express in looks, this is my niece.
Just so, Mr. Nickleby, replied Madame Mantalini, surveying Kate from head to foot and back again. Can you speak French, child?
Yes, ma'am, replied Kate, not daring to look up, for she felt that the eyes of the odious man in the dressing gown were directed towards her.
Like a damned native? Asked the husband. Miss Nickleby offered no reply to this inquiry, but turned her back upon the questioner, as if addressing herself to make answers to what his wife might demand.
"We keep 20 young women constantly employed in the establishment," said Madame.
"Indeed, ma'am," replied Kate, timidly.
"Yes, and some of them damned handsome, too," said the master.
"Mantalini!" exclaimed his wife in an awful voice.
"My senses idle," said Mantalini. "Do you wish to break my heart? Oh, no, not for 20,000 hemispheres populated with little ballet dancers," replied Mantalini in a poetical strain.
"Then you will, if you persevere in that mode of speaking," said his wife. "What can Mr. Nickleby think when he hears you?"
"Oh, nothing, ma'am, nothing," replied Ralph. "I know his amiable nature and yours. Mere little remarks that give a zest to your daily intercourse, lovers' quarrels that add sweetness to those domestic joys which promise to last so long. That's all, that's all."
If an iron door could be supposed to quarrel with its hinges and to make a firm resolution to open with slow obstinacy and grind them to powder in the process, it would emit a pleasanter sound in so doing than did these words in the rough and bitter voice in which they were uttered by Ralph. Even Mr. Mantalini felt their influence and, turning affrighted round, exclaimed,
"What a damned horrid croaking!"
"You will pay no attention, if you please, to what Mr. Mantalini says," observed his wife, addressing Miss Nickleby.
I do not, ma'am," said Kate with quiet contempt.
"Mr. Mantalini knows nothing whatever about any of the young women," continued Madame, looking at her husband and speaking to Kate. "If he has seen any of them, he must have seen them in the street going to or returning from their work, and not here. He was never even in the room. I do not allow it. What hours of work have you been accustomed to?"
I have never yet been accustomed to work at all, ma'am," replied Kate in a low voice.
For which reason she'll work all the better now," said Ralph, putting in a word, lest this confession should injure the negotiation.
"I hope so," returned Madame Mantalini. "Our hours are from 9 to 9. With extra work when we're very full of business, for which I allow payment as overtime."
Kate bowed her head to intimate that she heard and was satisfied.
"Your meals," continued Madame Mantalini, "that is, dinner and tea, you will take here. I should think your wages would average from 5 to 7 shillings a week, but I can't give you any certain information on that point until I see what you can do."
Kate bowed her head again.
"If you're ready to come," said Madame Mantalini, "you had better begin on Monday morning at 9 exactly, and Miss Nag, the forewoman, shall have directions to try you with some easy work at first. Is there anything more, Mr. Nickleby?"
"Nothing more, ma'am," said Ralph, rising.
"Then I believe that is all," said the lady. Having arrived at this natural conclusion, she looked at the door as if she wished to be gone, but hesitated notwithstanding, as though unwilling to leave to Mr. Mantalini the sole honour of showing them downstairs. Ralph relieved her from her perplexity by taking his departure without delay,
Madame Mantalini making many gracious inquiries why he never came to see them, and Mr. Mantalini anathematizing the stairs with great volubility as he followed them down, in the hope of inducing Kate to look around, a hope, however, which was destined to remain ungratified. "There," said Ralph when they got into the street. "Now you're provided for." Kate was about to thank him again, but he stopped her. "I had some idea," he said, "of providing for your mother in a pleasant part of the country." He had a presentation to some almshouses on the borders of Cornwall, which had occurred to him more than once. "But as you want to be together, I must do something else for her. Does she have a little money?"
"A very little," replied Kate.
"A little will go a long way, if it's used sparingly," said Ralph. "She must see how long she can make it last, living rent-free. You leave your lodgings on Saturday."
You told us to do so, Uncle.
"Yes. There is a house empty that belongs to me, which I can put you into. Tell it is let, and then if nothing else turns up, perhaps I shall have another. You must live there."
"Is it far from here, sir?" inquired Kate.
"Pretty well," said Ralph. "In another quarter of the town, at the east end, but I'll send my clerk down to you at 5 o'clock on Saturday to take you there. Goodbye. You know your way. Straight on."
Coldly shaking his niece's hand, Ralph left her at the top of Regent Street and turned down a by-thoroughfare intent on schemes of money-getting. Kate walked sadly back to their lodgings in the Strand. Chapter 11. Newman Noggs inducts Mr. and Mrs. Nickleby into their new dwelling in the city. Miss Nickleby's reflections as she wended her way homewards were of that desponding nature which the occurrences of the morning had been sufficiently calculated to awaken. Her uncle's was not a manner likely to dispel any doubts or apprehensions she might have formed in the outset. Neither was the glimpse she had of Madame Mantalini's establishment by any means encouraging. It was with many gloomy forebodings and misgivings, therefore, that she looked forward with a heavy heart to the opening of her new career. If her mother's consolations could have restored her to a pleasanter and more enviable state of mind, there were abundance of them to produce the effect. By the time Kate reached home, the good lady had called to mind two authentic cases of milliners who had been possessed of considerable property, though whether they had acquired it all in business, or had had capital to start with, or had been lucky and married to advantage, she could not exactly remember. However, as she very logically remarked, there must have been some young person in that way of business who had made a fortune without having anything to begin with, and that being taken for granted, why should not Kate do the same? Miss La Creevy, who was a member of the little council, ventured to insinuate some doubts relative to the probability of Miss Nickleby arriving at this happy consummation in the compass of an ordinary lifetime, but the good lady set that question entirely at rest by informing them that she had a presentiment on the subject, a species of second sight with which she had been in the habit of clenching every argument with the deceased Mr. Nickleby, and in 9 cases and 3/4 out of every 10 determining it the wrong way.
"I am afraid it is an unhealthy occupation," said Miss La Creevy. "I recollect getting 3 young milliners to sit for me when I first began to paint, and I remember that they were all very pale and sickly."
"Oh, that's not the general rule by any means," observed Mrs. Nickleby, "for I remember as well as if it was only yesterday, employing one that I was particularly recommended to make me a scarlet cloak at the time when scarlet cloaks were fashionable. She had a very red face indeed."
"Ah, perhaps she drank," suggested Miss La Creevy. "Oh, I don't know how that may have been," returned Mrs. Nickleby, "but I know she had a very red face, so your argument goes for nothing." In this manner, and with like powerful reasoning, did the worthy matron meet every little objection that presented itself to the new scheme of the morning. Happy Mrs. Nickleby! A project had but to be new, and it came home to her mind, brightly varnished and gilded as a glittering toy. This question disposed of, Kate communicated her uncle's desire about the empty house, to which Mrs. Nickleby assented with equal readiness, characteristically remarking that,
on the fine evenings, it would be a pleasant amusement for her to walk to the West End to fetch her daughter home, and no less characteristically forgetting that there were such things as wet nights and bad weather to be encountered in almost every week of the year.
"I shall be sorry, truly sorry to leave you, my kind friend," said Kate, on whom the good feeling of the poor miniature painter had made a deep impression.
"Oh, you shall not shake me off for all that," replied Miss La Creevy, with as much sprightliness as she could assume. "I shall see you very often, and come and hear how you get on. And if, in all London or all the wide world besides, there is no other heart that takes an interest in your welfare, there will be one little lonely woman that prays for it night and day." With this, the poor soul, who had a heart big enough for Gog, the guardian genius of London, and enough to spare for Magog to boot, after making a great many extraordinary faces which would have secured her an ample fortune could she have transferred them to ivory or canvas, sat down in a corner and had what she termed a real good cry. But no crying or talking or hoping or fearing could keep off the dreaded Saturday afternoon, or Newman Noggs either, who, punctual to this time, limped up to the door and breathed a whiff of cordial gin through the keyhole, exactly as such of the church clocks in the neighbourhood as agreed among themselves about the time struck five. Newman waited for the last stroke, and then he knocked.
"From Mr. Ralph Nickleby," said Newman, announcing his errand, when he got upstairs with all possible brevity.
"We shall be ready directly," said Kate. "We have not much to carry, but I fear we must have a coach."
"I will get one," replied Newman.
"Indeed, you shall not trouble yourself," said Mrs. Nickleby.
"I will," said Newman.
"I can't suffer you to think of such a thing," said Mrs. Nickleby.
"You can't help it," said Newman.
"Not help it?"
"No. I thought of it as I came along, but didn't get one, thinking you mightn't be ready. I think of a great many things. Nobody can prevent that."
"Oh, yes, I understand you, Mr. Noggs," said Mrs. Nickleby. "Our thoughts are free, of course. Everybody's thoughts are their own, clearly."
"Yeah, well, they wouldn't be if some people had their way," muttered Newman.
"Well, no more wonderful, no more they would, Mr. Noggs. And that's very true," rejoined Mrs. Nickleby. "Some people, to be sure, are so... How is your master?" Newman darted a meaning glance at Kate and replied with a strong emphasis on the last word of his answer that Mr. Ralph Nickleby was well and sent his love.
"I'm sure we're very much obliged to him," observed Mrs. Nickleby.
"Very," said Newman. "I'll tell him so." It was no very easy matter to mistake Newman Noggs after having once seen him, and as Kate, attracted by the singularity of his manner, in which on this occasion, however, there was something respectful and even delicate, notwithstanding the abruptness of his speech, looked at him more closely, she recollected having caught a passing glimpse of that strange figure before.
"Excuse my curiosity," she said, "but did I not see you in the coachyard on the morning my brother went away to Yorkshire?"
Newman cast a wistful glance on Mrs. Nickleby and said,
"No."
Almost unblushingly.
"No," exclaimed, I should have said so anywhere."
"You would have said wrong," rejoined Newman. "It's the first time I've been out in weeks. I've had the gout."
Newman was very, very far from having the appearance of a gouty subject, and so Kate could not help thinking. But the conference was cut short by Mrs. Nickleby's insisting on having the door shut, lest Mr. Noggs should take cold, and further persisting in sending the servant girl for a coach for fear he should bring on another attack of his disorder. To both conditions, Newman was compelled to yield. Presently the coach came, and after many sorrowful farewells and a great deal of running backwards and forwards across the pavement on the part of Miss La Creevy, in the course of which the yellow turban came into violent contact with sundry foot passengers, it, that is to say the coach, not the turban, went away again with the two ladies and their luggage inside, and Newman, despite all Mrs. Nickleby's assurances that it would be his death, on the box beside the driver. They went into the city, turning down by the riverside, and after a long and very slow drive, the streets being crowded at that hour with vehicles of every kind, stopped in front of a large, old, dingy house in Thames Street. the door and windows of which were so bespattered with mud that it would have appeared to have been uninhabited for years. The door of this deserted mansion Newman opened with a key which he took out of his hat, in which, by the by, in consequence of the dilapidated state of his pockets, he deposited everything, and would most likely have carried his money, if he had had any, and the coach being discharged, he led the way into the interior of the mansion. Old and gloomy and black, in truth it was, and sullen and dark were the rooms, once so bustling with life and enterprise. There was a wharf behind, opening on the Thames, an empty dog kennel, some bones of animals, fragments of iron hoops and staves of old casks lay strewn about, but no life was stirring there. It was a picture of cold, silent decay. "This house depresses and chills me," said Kate, "and seems as if some blight had fallen on it. If I was superstitious, I should be almost inclined to believe that some dreadful crime had been perpetrated within these old walls, and that the place had never prospered since. How frowning and how dark it looks." "Oh, Lord, my dear," replied Mrs. Nickleby, "don't talk in that way, or you'll frighten me to death." It's only my foolish fancy, Mama," said Kate, forcing a smile. "Well then, my love, I wish you would keep your foolish fancy to yourself, and not wake up my foolish fancy to keep it company," retorted Mrs. Nickleby. "Why didn't you think of all this before? You are so careless. We might have asked Miss La Creevy to keep us company, or borrowed a dog, or a thousand things. But it always was the way, and was just the same with your poor dear father. Unless I thought of everything..." This was Mrs. Nickleby's usual commencement of general lamentation, running through a dozen or so complicated sentences addressed to nobody in particular, and into which she now launched until her breath was exhausted. Newman appeared not to hear these remarks, but preceded them to a couple of rooms on the first floor, which some kind of an attempt had been made to render habitable. In one there were a few chairs, a table, an old hearth rug and some faded baize, and a fire was ready laid in the grate. In the other stood an old tent bedstead and a few scanty articles of chamber furniture. "Well, my dear," said Mrs. Nickleby, trying to be pleased, "now isn't this thoughtful and considerate of your uncle? Why, we should not have had anything but the bed we bought yesterday to lie down upon, if it hadn't been for his thoughtfulness." "Very kind indeed," replied Kate, looking around. Newman Noggs did not say that he had hunted up the furniture they saw from attic and cellar, or that he had taken in the halfpenny worth of milk for tea that stood upon a shelf, or filled the rusty kettle on the hob, or collected the wood chips from the wharf, or begged the coals. But the notion of Ralph Nickleby having directed it to be done tickled his fancy so much that he could not refrain from cracking all his 10 fingers in succession, at which performance Mrs. Nickleby was rather startled at first, but supposing it to be some remote manner connected with the gout, did not remark upon.
"We need not detain you longer, I think," said Kate.
"Is there nothing I can do?" asked Newman.
"Nothing, thank you," rejoined Miss Nickleby.
"Perhaps, my dear, Mr. Noggs would like to drink our healths," said Mrs. Nickleby, fumbling in her reticulae for some small coin.
"I think, ma'am, Mama," said Kate, hesitating and remarking Newman's averted face, "you would hurt his feelings if you offered it."
Newman Noggs, bowing to the young lady more like a gentleman than the miserable wretch he seemed, placed his hand upon his breast, and pausing for a moment with the air of a man who struggles to speak but is uncertain what to say, quitted the room. As the jarring echoes of the heavy house door, closing on its latch, reverberated dismally through the building, Kate felt half tempted to call him back and beg him to remain a little while. But she was ashamed to her own fears, and Newman Noggs was on his road homewards. And that's our book reading for today. We'll be back, hopefully next Monday, with more of Nicholas Nickleby and the trials and tribulations of Nicholas at Dothbury Hall. And, well, what will happen to Kate and her mother? And what about our friend, Mr. Noggs? What an unusual person. Well, hopefully we'll learn more next Monday. Till then, have a safe and a good week.